International House of Horrors.
Valued guests, and welcome back to the International House of Horrors podcast, your sanctuary of spooky for all things terrible, horrible, brutal, bloody, gory, and the macabre. I am one of your curators here at the house, Joe Merle.
And I'm the other one. I'm Josh. Hi, Joe.
Hey, Josh. Hello, Josh. Hi, Josh. I got to figure out the best way to do it. Hi, Josh. Hello, Josh. What's going on, man? How are you?
Yeah, I just come from band practice and I got a big blister on my finger, but I'm good otherwise. And what's going on with you?
No, not a whole lot. Got up this morning. We're recording a little bit later than usual. So I had time to get I did like an hour on the treadmill, watched a movie my brother had recommended to me. That was pretty good. It's on Netflix called Freaks. Have you heard of this?
Freaks? Never heard of it, no.
Yeah, it's not a horror movie. It's more of a sci-fi kind of superhero-ish, I guess, type movie, even though they're not really superheroes. But it was good. If you get a chance, I would say check it out for sure. It's got who's in it? Yeah. Emile Hirsch plays a big part, and then Bruce Dern's in there as well. So it's solid.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
I'll check it out. Yeah, sounds good.
But we are not here to talk about Freaks. We are
we're not here to talk about anything other than horror movies.
Right. Horror movies and a scary little spooky show known as The Twilight Zone. And we've made it to the end of season one. Today we're going to be discussing A World of His Own. This was episode 36 from season one. It was directed by Ralph Nelson, written by Richard Matheson, and the original air date was July 1st, 1960. And we don't have a lot of players really in this one. You've just got Keenan Wynn plays Gregory West, Phyllis Kirk as Victoria West, and Marie LaRoche as Mary. And with this one, so the opening narration, I will do my best here, but it's important to note that there's a lot of things happening while the opening narration takes place.
Yeah, I was already wondering while watching, how are you going to do this? And I'm also excited about the closing narration.
Yeah, the closing narration is going to be a tricky one. But this one, so I guess I'll just go through it. And then, you know what? I'll just read the whole thing. Then we can just talk through what happens because I feel like there will be a lot of breaks in there. Best. And it's not very long. So here we go. The home of Mr. Gregory West, one of America's most noted playwrights. The office of Mr. Gregory West. Mr. Gregory West, shy, quiet, and at the moment, very happy. Mary, warm, affectionate, and the final ingredient, Mrs. Gregory West. Okay, so to kind of give an idea of what was going on there, we open up, we probably got 2, maybe 3 minutes, I would say, that's actually happening on screen while this narration's happening. And we see this playwright.
Yeah, while it's happening, that's important. Like, he's saying Mr. Gregory West's house. Then it goes on a bit, and then Mr. Gregory West.
And then we see Gregory West. Right.
Yeah.
And then we see Mary, who is fixing him a cocktail or something like that. We see her.
They're really flirty.
Yes, yes. They're like sitting on the couch together, very, very flirty. And then when you get to that final line, you know, and the final ingredient, Mrs. Gregory West, we see her outside peeking in through the window.
And yeah, then and already looking shocked a bit.
Right, looking angry.
Yeah, and then the narration is done, and that's already it. We're right in the story. There is no Twilight Zone at the end of it this time.
No, there's nothing. So, we jump right in, and I like this, that the whole thing takes place in a single setting. We really don't go anywhere outside of this guy's office, and... I thought as I was watching this, I was like, man, this would make a really good stage play. You know, it's like perfect. It's set up perfect for a stage play. And this is Richard Matheson doing what he does well, tells a very cool science fiction story. And in this one, we've got Gregory West. So his wife ends up, Mrs. West ends up coming in and she's frantically looking around the room. Like, where did she go? Where did she go? You know, she's looking, hey, you know, sweetie, do you have any secret doors in this place where somebody could come and go if
very
they wanted
nonchalantly
to?
Just like, is there a secret door? And we got to say before she comes in, he talks to Mary and she says again, and he says, oh, yes, right. Again. And then We don't see where she disappears. We just know she's not in the room with him anymore.
That's right. Yeah, we do see. We don't know where she went, but we do know that she's no longer there. She's gone. And so Mrs. West, I forget when he first reveals to her what's going on. She looks around for a while. They have some dialogue for quite a bit of time before he tells her and he lets her know. He's like, hey, I just want you to know I can bring characters to life from my stories. Like, I can talk into, he's got like a machine that he dictates into. He writes and he talks into this microphone and then he says, hey, I'm going to prove it to you. And the whole time Mrs. West is like, you're fucking crazy. I'm going to have you committed. And so he locks her in there, locks her in the room, sticks the key in his pocket, and she's adamant that he's nuts. So he's like, I'm going to show you, just let me show you. And so he gets on the machine, he starts to dictate, and he's very, how did he describe it? He says, you know, I brought Mary back so many times or something like that. I can do it really fast. Like, Mary's been here.
Knows exactly what to say to get her to appear. And then he just starts talking and says, like, says her name. She's blonde, that height, looks beautiful, is nice. And he just says who she is. And then it starts also saying, while his wife fishes a key out of his pocket,
right.
He starts actually saying, like, and she's now walking up the stairs, going into the front door, and she's there. And then she, right. You hear the door clicking when he says that she opens the front door, and then she stands in the hallway and comes in. And
I love the way that Mary and Mrs. West look at each other around the door too. I mean, this felt very much like a late 50s, early 60s sitcom. In that way, you know, you had some of these kind of fun comedic moments in there as well. So now, also, go ahead.
Mary and like Mary looks almost like she knows who this is. Like she is already relaxed and is kind of wondering why Mrs. West is so angry, and Mrs. West is just shocked.
Yeah, she's looking like, Gregory, why would you bring me back right now? And that's when he's like, okay, and now I'm going to show you how I get rid of the people. And what he does is he takes whatever piece of tape that he had recorded on, that he had dictated on, balls it up, throws it in the fire, and now whoever's there disappears. And we see that with Mary this time. And you feel kind of bad for Mary, though, because she says, like, don't do this again. Don't bring me back. Like, I'm tired.
Yeah, she says, this time, stop bringing me back. Like, usually I guess she liked being there, and he always brought her back. But then, yeah, he has to get rid of her again. So every time he just throws her in the fire, and she's fed up with it. And by this time she says, don't ever bring me back. And it's like tears in her eyes. It's really emotional.
Which makes me wonder, though, do they retain some sort of memory after their film is burned or after the tape is burned?
Yeah, I guess so. Because, yeah, she says again and she remembers things, I guess. And also, otherwise, she'd come back not knowing anything.
Right.
So I guess they retain some memory, yeah.
And Victoria West, Mrs. West, still doesn't fully believe him, what he's doing, even after she watches Mary disappear into thin air. She's like, where did she go? Where did she go?
And she once again wants him committed, yeah.
Yeah, wants him committed. She's convinced that he's trying to have her committed, trying to make her crazy. So she ends up, is going to take off, and I love that he manifests a red-eyed elephant in the hallway.
Yeah.
And we actually get this great shot of an elephant. I mean, this full-bore elephant in this hallway, you know, blowing its trunk way up kind of in the air. It was a lot of fun.
I'm guessing that's because the rest of the movie is just set, like all of the movie is just set in his apartment and in the floor right in front of it. And so they didn't need much budget. So I guess most of the budget went into getting the elephant there.
Yeah.
Because
and
there
I'm
was
sure.
actually an elephant there in the floor. In the
right,
hallway.
Right. There was an elephant there. And I wonder, though, they probably had somebody, you know, close by, some, who knows, animal service or something like that. It's Hollywood.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah.
And so now Victoria still doesn't believe him. Even after the elephant, she still swears up and down she's going to have him committed, and that's when he goes over to the safe, and he opens the safe. She's like, oh, how long have you had that there for? She opens the safe, or he opens the safe, and pulls out an envelope with her name on it, and he pulls out the film, And she's trying to, she says, oh, you're trying to make me believe that this is actually me and I'm one of your manifestations. He says, look at you. You're perfect. You're regal. You're beautiful. You're all these things. You're what I thought I wanted in a wife. And I brought you to life. I did this. And she doesn't believe
me. He even asks, like, why did you end up with me?
Right. Of all the people you could have. Yeah. Of all the people you could have, why do you think you ended up with me? And she then takes the envelope. She's like, I don't believe your superstitious nonsense. She throws the whole envelope in the fire, turns around, and then we get this shocked look on her face. Like she's starting to go, and then we see her disappear into nothing.
Yeah, and that's horrible. And then he thinks about bringing her back.
He runs over to the dictator, and I don't even, is that what you call a machine that dictates? A dictator? Seems like a weird name for it. I don't know. But he runs over to the machine and starts to say, her name is Veronica. And then he's like, wait a minute. Why not just leave well enough alone? Like, she's gone. I don't have to deal with her anymore. And so then he starts to describe Mary again. And he brings Mary back. But now Mary is his wife in this situation. Yeah,
exactly. And they're both happy. And I just looked it up, and so IMDb says it's a recorder that he uses.
Just a recorder?
Not a dictator, okay. Just a recorder, yeah.
Even though I think he said it a few times, like, I dictate on this recorder. Yeah, I guess that makes sense. So now we get to the end of this thing, which is so much fun. Such a cool thing and a great way to end out the first season. So in a lot of these episodes, you maybe not up to this point, but once we get further into these seasons, you know, Serling would be on screen giving the opening narration. You'd actually see him. He'd be standing there smoking a cigarette or having a coffee or something like that. And he appears at the end of this one. The camera pans over, and I'll read what he says and then kind of explain it. So Serling is sitting on the desk talking, and he says, "We hope you enjoyed tonight's romantic story on the Twilight Zone. At the same time, we want you to realize that it was, of course, purely fiction. In real life, such ridiculous nonsense could never..." And then he cuts out. And then we go over to Gregory, who says, Rod, you shouldn't. And he walks over to the safe and he pulls out an envelope with tape inside it marked Rod Serling. I mean, you shouldn't say, and then he says, I mean, you shouldn't say such things as nonsense and ridiculous. And then he throws the tape into the fire. And we see Serling disappear the same way everybody else did. We see Gregory and Mary start having a drink. And then we get the actual closing narration, which is this. "Leaving Mr. Gregory West, still shy, quiet, very happy, and apparently in complete control of the Twilight Zone." Which is just fucking awesome. That they wrote it in like that was very cool. And they actually did something a little bit similar in the new iteration of The Twilight Zone, the one that came out last year on CBS All Access. The final episode, it suffered because of a couple things I'm not going to say just in case anybody hasn't seen it yet, because I thought it was the best episode of the entire season. But it suffered because of a few things. But in this instance, I thought it was just a ton of fun. Like, we're gonna you know, play this thing at a meta level. And now Gregory's not only, you know, the Twilight Zone show exists in the Twilight Zone. You know, it's really cool. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, now it's really getting meta and double meta, I guess.
Right? Yeah, double and triple meta. So that's it for season one. Season one of the Twilight Zone.
We actually made it through a whole season.
Got it all wrapped up. Yeah, man, we got it all wrapped up. So today, for the main topic, this is one that you had wanted to talk about. I'm excited to talk about this because it's some stuff that I had never seen before, and it's always exciting to see movies that I haven't seen before, and I feel like there is a lot to talk about these movies, so why don't we just jump right into it? I'm going to let you give the full setup and why we're even discussing this and what we're going to be talking about.
Yeah, so not too long ago, I read a tweet that José Mojica Marins died on the 19th of February 2020. He was 83 years old, so he had a good run at life. And that name might not ring a bell to any of our listeners. I think you didn't hear it before either.
I didn't know his name, but I had heard Coffin Joe before. Okay. But I didn't know who he was, and I hadn't seen any of the movies. Maybe I haven't even heard Coffin Joe, but I know I had at least seen some images from, like, even comic conventions and things that I feel like he did later in life.
Because here in, well, over there in the US and also here in Germany and most of the world, I think people barely know about him and maybe have heard of Coffin Joe, his most famous character. But in... So now I got to look it up because I always forget. He's in Brazil,
Portugal.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, Brazil.
In Brazil, he was like a megastar, basically. Like just last year or 2 years ago, they had on a carnival thing, they had a float of Coffin Joe flying by there because he is the biggest guy ever. And more importantly for us, he made the very first Brazilian horror movie that ever was,
right?
And its sequel and like lots of other movies following up. And I had seen the first two before. Actually, I found out I've seen the first four before, and I just forgot about most of them,
which is kind of awesome.
But there's three main movies that are just centered around this character, and we're going to talk about two of them because the third one I couldn't get my hands on in time, and I think you couldn't either.
Yeah, it looks so, like I could have rented it. I think it's available on... I don't know why I thought he was from Portugal. You're right, it's Brazil.
He's speaking Portuguese, so maybe...
Oh, maybe that's what it was. Yeah, but I thought I saw the that he was listed... Oh, we lost Josh.
No, I'm still here.
Oh, there you are.
Something weird happened. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that was weird. My screen went all blank and I couldn't see you, so you might have to cut that. And then I'll try and lead right back into what I was talking about. So the last thing I said was he was credited. I don't know. I'll just have to jump back into it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I've read he's sometimes cited as Brazil's Freddy Krueger. Which people have called him from time to time, which I don't completely understand, but I guess could.
Maybe because Freddy Krueger is like the biggest, like he was the guy that where Robert Englund went to.
Oh yeah, that's fair.
To live shows, and he was like a character that really everyone loved him.
Well, and I wonder if this guy, you know, if parents didn't tell their kids and shit, like, hey, if you're bad, Coffin Joe's gonna come get you.
That might be.
Yeah, he really is a nightmare. But Embodiment of Evil, I'll probably end up watching it. It's interesting that it's so many years after, and it made me think of the Mother of Tears trilogy and how we didn't get the Mother of Tears movie until so much later. You had the first two.
Yeah.
You know, and Argento didn't do Mother of Tears until probably, I think, around the same time, right? Like 2008, 2007, somewhere right in there.
Let's see. Because I think maybe even 11. Let me 2007. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is kind of the same situation where you had these first two Coffin Joe movies and the third one to come out so many years after those first two had already been released. So we're going to talk about these first two. And first up is At Midnight, I'll Take Your Soul from 1964. Yeah.
Which is already, I love the title already. Like you go into a movie that's called At Midnight, I'll Take Your Soul. And that's already great. And doesn't it start with like a witch telling us to not watch this movie?
Yeah, by the time you leave the theater, all this stuff will happen. And I was talking to Summy about it. I was telling him what we were going to talk about today when we recorded. And I had sent him like, hey, both these two movies. He's like, I never heard of them, never seen them. I said, well, they're both on YouTube. You can check them out. And I sent him the titles for both of them. And he said that. He's like, man, those are cool titles though, aren't they? And I was like, yeah, they're pretty rad. So we'll start with this. We'll get to the second one after that. But At Midnight, I'll Take Your Soul. This, where do you even start with these movies? So Coffin Joe... might be the most arrogant character ever captured on film.
Yes. And like it feels like at least from like because this movie Coffin Joe is played by Jose Marans, and he's also the director and the writer, and it feels so much like he was playing himself and he's maybe this kind of asshole.
Yeah.
Because not only is Coffin Joe the most arrogant character in film, he's also always right. Like
he's always right. Women just fall in love with him in seconds. You know, doesn't take more than two seconds for him to be there. I did read about him, though, after, I don't know if it was before he made this movie, but he had actually opened a theater school in Brazil or something like that. Okay. Like he had done some work when I was kind of looking at it, because I was trying to learn more about the guy. But in these movies, the Coffin Joe character is just, he's the toughest guy in the room all the time. Women love him immediately. He doesn't believe
everyone's
in anything.
Everyone's scared of him.
Yeah, everyone else is terrified of him. He doesn't believe in anything but himself, his blood. The point of these movies is just him trying to have a baby. It's because he feels the only way that you can have true immortality is through blood. I mean, he's constantly like calling on God and the devil. Like, if you're really there, you show me. I don't believe in any of you anyway. Like all the time he's having monologues.
I think we haven't really set the date yet, but this movie is from 1964.
Yeah.
And so at that time in Brazil, especially, I'm guessing that alone is already like
controversial.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. To
very
have like
controversial.
The leading character of the movie shout these kind of things. And the movie starts off with him like, I don't know how it, like he gives a monologue right at the beginning, right?
We see his face like real close, a tight shot on his face.
Yeah.
And then you get these texts, title cards and stuff flashing real crazy. Ah, like going nuts in front of you.
Yeah, exactly. And then he, after this monologue, like we get the start of this movie. Like he is living with his with his. I'm not sure if she's his wife or just his girlfriend.
I thought she was his. Yeah, I don't know if she was the wife or girlfriend, but I want to. Maybe she was his. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know.
They were at least together because. Right. Then he gets a visit, and this is also the greatest, is that this asshole of a character that we learn, everyone fears him and he's the worst, but he's got a girlfriend and he's got a best friend, Antonio.
Right.
Who comes in to talk to him, like Antonio and his girlfriend come in.
Oh, you know what though? I'm reading right now and it was his wife.
It was his wife.
Lenita
okay.
was his wife.
Yeah, and Antonio and his wife and his girlfriend come in, and like Joe is already completely into Antonio's girlfriend.
Yeah,
and later on, his wife even says like, "You make me crazy. You can't start looking at her like that all the time."
Didn't he even grab her up outside? Was that when he grabbed her outside, or was that after he killed his wife?
I think that was after, like when they do the
and
walk,
we should note that his profession, he is an undertaker, so that's where the name Coffin Joe I think comes from.
Yeah, he's an undertaker, and he's always wearing like completely dressed in black. He's got a top hat and he's got a cape
and a crazy unibrow.
Yeah, they actually exaggerated that in the later movies where he just appears for a second, like where it's actually like a V.
Yeah, it looked to me, because I think I had seen some pictures from the movies that came later, the same way Groucho Marx mustache almost painted on, it looked the same way for his eyebrow. Super thick
exactly.
And heavy. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it already starts, and it's like one of my favorite things, because if you think about it now, it's not really that shocking, but probably at the time it was super controversial, is when he says like he wants a lamp, he wants his wife to prepare a lamp, and it's Good Friday by the way, on the day this movie plays, it's Good Friday, and he says like and she says, "You can't have meat, it's Good Friday." And he says like, "I'm gonna have meat, and even if it's human flesh,"
right,
or something like that.
Yeah, and he has a just deep disdain for any sort of religion, religion, and truly believes, as we had mentioned earlier, that everyone else is wrong but him. He's everyone else. Yeah. Everybody else is wrong except for him.
Yeah, and yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah, and then. He goes, then we even see the scene where he's like sitting at his window eating his meat. And then this, what's it called when they all do the walk?
A parade or a procession? No,
yeah,
they weren't
the procession,
having a,
exactly.
Was it a funeral procession?
No, I think it was just the Good Friday procession. Isn't
that
a thing?
Okay. Like, yeah, you might be right.
And the priest is standing there and sees it and just sees him, looks with disdain, and then like does the cross thing, and then they walk on, and that's the end of that scene. We just needed to see that he really doesn't care and eats meat on the holy day.
And he does whatever he wants. And yeah. I think it's shortly thereafter that he finds out that his wife can't get pregnant. She can't get pregnant. Yeah. She's not going to be able to bear a child. So what do you do with a woman who can't bear a child? You fucking kill her with venomous spiders. Why not? That's what you do. This guy is a lunatic. Watching these movies, I completely understand why they are important, and I enjoy them, but I don't think... So I watched both of the first two back-to-back. I think you almost need time in between, because he is so much as a character to take on. Like, I despised him and loathed him to the point where I was almost like, I can't even just watch this asshole be this way anymore. Because he really is, like, the scum of the earth.
Yeah, and it somehow it really feels like you start hating the director because he wrote this character and plays him.
Yeah.
So, like, you really start thinking, okay, that guy must be an asshole. Maybe he's the nicest guy, but I will forever think of him as like the complete asshole because
because he's so bad.
These movies.
I think we only see one piece of compassion, and that's not until the next movie is when we actually see it. So we'll get there.
There's one thing he likes, and that's kids. Like they are the best thing on earth because they're still innocent. I think
before they're corrupted into adulthood and become stupid pieces of shit. How he sees everybody else.
Yeah, but that mostly happens in the second movie. So he kills his wife with like in the movie we don't see he doesn't even say that it's a venomous spider. We just see him putting the spider on her and then she's dead.
Yeah, right away. This guy's got a thing for spiders. When we talk about the next one, even though that was so well done. So now his wife's dead, and throughout all of these movies, as many people as he kills, they can never pin it on him. They always say, oh, there's not enough evidence. There's not enough evidence to say it was him. There's not enough evidence. So a couple days later, Coffin Joe and Antonio go to see a local gypsy and have their fortunes told. And
I think you skipped that part where he also goes to the bar and like whips a guy in the bar so much that his whole head is full of marks of his whip. Antonio comes in to save him and says like, don't kill him, and you'll have to do the whole thing.
Right.
He says, oh yes, from now on every human that I killed, I will want double of the payment.
Right.
Oh, so that's right. He actually wants more money for the people he killed.
Right. That's right. Which, he tells them all, I'll charge you double for anybody that I murder. This guy, I'm telling you, man, Coffin Joe, he is something.
He is the worst.
So then I even sent you a message after I got almost all the way through the first one. I was like, holy fuck, man. Like, this guy is so bad. I was like, is this guy the worst person ever? And you're like, he absolutely is, without a doubt. So then they They go to the fortune teller, and she gives starts to give them a fortune, and we'll just call him Coffin Joe. Immediately begins to mock the supernatural. Throughout all these movies, he'll just stop and be like, it's all bullshit. It's all this and that. Even when lightning hits a tree, he's like, show me a sign. Lightning hits a tree, lights on fire and falls on his legs. And he's like, I still don't believe it. No matter what, I still don't believe
it. To skip ahead a bit, he goes down to hell and he still doesn't believe it.
Right. He thinks it's just a vision. So they're at this, back to where we're at though, they're at this fortune teller and she says that, what does she tell him? That disaster is going to hit. Some kind of disaster is going to hit. There's going to be, that Antonio's never going to get married. That he's never going to be able to marry the love of his life. Coffin Joe continues to say, oh, this is bullshit. And shortly thereafter, they go to Antonio's house and they're just hanging out, having a drink, stuff like that. And they continue to discuss the idea of the supernatural, have kind of a normal discussion about it. And then out of nowhere, Joe just grabs a statue of some sort, this huge blunt object, and just bludgeons Antonio to death so that he can take his fiance.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, we had a scene before where he walked alone with Antonio's fiance and talked to her. And like she said, you have your wife at home. And also, I have Antonio, and that's why he gets the idea, okay, I'll need to kill both of them because I need her.
Also, he needs her womb to make the perfect human.
Yeah. We totally forgot one thing that we have to talk about. His room is amazing. He has all these hands hanging out everywhere from the wall that he, like, a hand as a coat hanger, a hand as a holder. Yeah. And I really love that.
You know, this is, but, for being this guy, I want to say it was like his first feature-length movie. He did a good job. He did a good job. Some of the dialogue is a little crazy, but some of that could be lost in translation. Who knows?
Yeah, I feel like the subtitles are not the best, yeah.
No, and I think we forgot to mention, though, when he's at the bar, we see him from time to time. Even when he was at the bar, he gets this really intense stare, and his eyes begin to fill like with blood
he's basically the Hulk, like his eyes fill with blood and then he starts like whipping ass and like no one can defeat him.
You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
So
he sets up Antonio in a way that looks like he hit his head in the bathtub and drowned. At least I think that's what he was doing when he was kind of smacking his head on the side of the tub to leave the blood there to make it look like he fell, and then
I think so, yeah,
went under the water. So now we have that. Oh go ahead.
I think one more thing that I want to add. I think at one point before that, he actually blinded someone by pushing his thumbs into his eyes.
Was that in this one?
Isn't that? I think that was in this one, yeah.
Okay.
This one already is so fucked up. And
yeah, so it's hard for me because I watched them right almost back to back. So some of the
me too.
Plot points are...
Wait, what did he do? No, he cut a finger off of someone in this one. That was it. I just remembered before all this, there is some brutal scene. And yeah, he cuts a finger off someone. And all the special effects are really good, especially for 1964. And like super gory. Like this is gore that even Night of the Living Dead isn't as gory as this one.
Right. Yeah, not at all. So you're right, because there is some good gore in this. It's a lot of cutaways and things like that, but they still show you a lot of the good gore.
And they have good makeup, yeah.
Right. And so now that Antonio's dead, he has these plans to seduce Antonio's fiance. She's not having any of it. So he beats the hell out of her and then rapes her. Even though we don't really see it, I thought it was assumed that he raped her.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
I mean, it wouldn't surprise me because, you know, he's just a horrible, horrible piece of shit.
And in the end, he just wants to make a baby. And
that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he doesn't need consent tells him, for it. Yeah, she tells him, or she doesn't tell him, but she puts a curse on him. And that's a big thing in a lot of these movies, well, at least in both of these movies as well, is the idea of curses. And then he leaves her there and he's always got this crazy maniacal laugh. Too, whenever he like does something, you know, really loud and exaggerated. So he's now raped her, thinking he's gonna have the ultimate child. She puts a curse on him, and the following day we find her hanging in her apartment, but she never names him in the suicide note. That's the thing, is she never clearly says, "Oh, this is who did it." And what had happened. So now the town's kind of in an uproar. There's all these violent deaths that have taken place, all kinds of stuff. And then, you know what I'm looking at right here? This is where he gouges the doctor's eyes out with the fingernails.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. And that scene was horrible and super brutal. And like that looked well done for a movie of that time.
It was really well done. And so he's still out there doing it. Coffin Joe hasn't been caught up yet. And we get to the third act where now the Day of the Dead is approaching. And in true Coffin Joe fashion, he's just telling everybody they're stupid and ignorant and they shouldn't believe all this bullshit. But this girl, Marta, shows up. she's back into town. I don't remember exactly why she was coming to town. I think she was just coming to visit relatives or something like that.
Yeah, she needed some place to stay. So, yeah, I don't remember fully exactly why. But, yeah, she came in town and just traveling through. And, yeah, she needs a place to stay. And, of course, it's the Day of the Dead, so no one goes out. They all stay at the bar they are in, I guess.
Yeah.
Because, like, all the people are always at this bar. And yeah, it's the Day of the Dead, and so Joe says, "Okay, I'm gonna lead you, because yeah, he now is fallen in love with this new girl because the old one died, so he needs a new one."
Yeah, and that's what he does in a lot of these movies. So he takes, they all give him a hard time. I remember that he says, "I'm gonna go out," and they say, "No, it's Day of the Dead. You can't go out." And he's like, "Bah ha 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 ha! You and your fucking ignorant superstitions. There is no God. There is only blood. Blood. Hereditary is the only way. I will make an immortal son." So he goes out, and that's when he sees a whole bunch of ghosts, which I thought was a really cool effect too, for the time. Yeah. You know, that sequence with all the ghosts, and he sees a vision of the gypsy who tells him that at midnight, you know, Satan's going to take his soul for everything that he had done, all the people that he had killed. And so he's out.
Yeah, and that's where she says the title, "At midnight, I'll take your soul."
Right. And
Or it says in the curse before that.
He remembers. Right, he remembers the curse, but then he sees the gypsy, who's the one, I want to say it was the gypsy who tells him. And we see him actually scared a little bit right here, which is so weird in both of these, is that he'll be truly terrified and then 2 minutes later be mocking, you know, everything that's happening. So he sees all these ghosts, he runs away, and I think this is where he takes off to the mausoleum, right? Where Antonio's fiance had been buried. He flips open their coffins and sees that their faces are just covered in maggots and rot and all of this stuff. And so the villagers all show up and find him in there, kind of really gross looking. Like, we never saw what happened, right? I just remember
we didn't see what happened, yeah.
Right.
But he's laying there dead, and his eyes are wide open and like almost swollen out of his head. Like they're so big. Yeah.
So he's got these huge bulging eyes covered in what look like bruises and cuts and things like that. There might even been some maggots on him. The quality on YouTube wasn't the highest quality, so it's kind of hard to see certain things.
My DVD was actually the quality of the YouTube video. It's,
you know,
it's not a good quality.
Yeah, and who knows what kind of film stock he shot this on back in 64. Exactly. Probably lower quality to save money, especially if you're trying to make your first movie. So he's in there, eyes all bulging out, really disfigured. And then we hear the chimes of the church bell signaling midnight, like it has happened. Midnight is upon us. And then that's kind of it for the first movie.
Yeah, that's the end. Like, Coffin Joe clearly dies at the end, would assume. Yeah, and it's kind of because this character really is the worst. And all throughout this movie, he was always right until this point. And then he actually dies at the end. So I guess it's not... He gets his comeuppance at least a little bit. He's scared to death and then actually dies. So,
right. And we think, or at least we're led to believe, that he truly is dead. But this movie, you know, did really well. It did really well.
Yeah.
And so people latched onto this thing. They were like, "Hey, we got to make this." He was probably like, "Hey, I'm making some money. Why not make another one of these movies?" And so in 1967, he put out "This Night I'll Possess Your Corpse." And again, it's
title.
Really cool. Yeah, great title. Very cool title.
I love how this second movie begins with, like, I mean, in the old Universal films, they already did like some great retcons where in the first movie you see Frankenstein, and in the first Frankenstein movie you see him fall down a windmill and then land and like totally break his back. But in the second movie, he's just a bit hurt.
Right.
But there, okay, it's 5 years in between. You couldn't see the movie other than maybe it was screening somewhere. So most people probably forgot it and it was okay. With this movie, they actually show the last scene of the movie again. Show him laying there like that and like completely disgusting looking. And then one of the villagers says, he's still alive. And that's right. it. He's and still alive.
They bring him back to life. And the movie opens up with a title card that tells us this immediately follows the events of the first movie. This is immediately following. So we get that. And then we see Joe. They wrap him up, got him bandaged up, take him to the hospital. And he's blind. I don't know if he's blind, but he has wrap around his face, covering up his eyes. I do remember that.
So I'm guessing for some time he was blind. Yeah. And because after he murdered so many people and they were sure like he's the worst guy ever, they of course put him into a hospital and made sure he's going to heal well and they're going to take care of him.
And then they absolve him for all his crimes. He's not held accountable for anything. And this is now Coffin Joe is back on the loose, back on the prowl, looking for another woman who he's going to use as the ultimate vessel to him creating the perfect super immortal man.
But this time he doesn't just like take the next best woman. No, he's going to do a contest.
Right. He's got a sick, very solo kind of contest going on.
Yeah. And we got to add though, suddenly he has like a hunchback,
assistant. Like a servant. Yeah. Assistant, servant, and a huge hunchback too. it's so big protruding out of this guy's back. But the one scene in here right near the beginning is what I was talking about, where you see his compassion, where we see a little boy is about to be hit by a car and Coffin Joe runs over, pulls him out of the street and saves him and tells him, children, perfect innocence, like you're the only good thing in the world.
But pulls him is maybe not the right word. He like kick jumps into him and kicks him off the street. That's how he saves him.
That's true. And so we've got Bruno the assistant. So this one I enjoyed more of the two. I think this one was a ton of fun.
Yeah.
So Bruno, his assistant, helps him kidnap all of these six women. So he's got six women all in, I don't know what room he was in or where he was at, where he had them all, but he's got them all in one room.
I think it was in his house. It was just like downstairs somewhere, it looked like.
Maybe. Yeah,
that's like the thing that's like, all of a sudden, he not only does have a hunchback assistant, but also like a basement with like trapdoors and everything you need.
Right.
Because that's what a good undertaker has at his home.
Trapdoors.
And we also see we see him capture all the girls like one after the other, and we gotta add that that one of them is pregnant, but Joe doesn't know that. But we get to see that. And he gets one of the, and the last one is actually like sitting there with a glass of wine and says like, I've been expecting you. You don't need force.
Right.
And just comes with him. Yeah.
Yeah. She just, and he puts them all in this room together and lets them know that he's only going to choose one of them. To your point, there's going to be some contests to determine who is the best vessel to carry Coffin Joe's child. And
who is the perfect woman?
And the way that he tests them all, which I got to give him credit, this was really well done. I don't know how those women laid there like that with all of those spiders climbing all over them. And not only for movie's sake, you know, you would wake up. If you had that many spiders crawling all over you, there's no way you wouldn't stir in your sleep or something like that. But to even, there must have been, I mean, how many spiders were in their room? They just kept shoving them underneath the door. And all of these.
Yeah, it was so many.
And these are all real spiders. I don't know if maybe there was a couple fake ones here and there, but for the most part, they were all moving, all real spiders. So you have six women sleeping in six different beds all in one room who are now covered in spiders. And Joe is peeking through these eye holes in the wall. He moves this thing aside, you know, very Scooby-Doo. And you just see his eyes peek in.
Yeah, and it's like giant eye holes. So this isn't like a hiding place. Like if someone looked at that wall, he would suddenly see that the one lamp is to the side and there's a hole where eyes look through.
Right.
So like it's not really one that isn't unnoticeable.
Yeah. And we get this great sequence of all of these spiders all over all these women. They slowly start to come to as Joe's watching. All of the women freak out save for one. There's only the one woman who just kind of looks around, doesn't get terrified, and Joe knows now that she's going to be the one. She's the one because she has courage. Like,
she actually like plays around with them a bit, like has them in their hand and pets them
Yeah, she even helped Bruno put some back in the box when Bruno came in there to get them all. She helps him put some away.
She is the one that expected him at the beginning, right? Like when he captured them. I think it was the same one. Because
she was the one who was also with the great big dude. I can't remember his name, but the big muscle-bound guy was pining after her.
Oh, yeah, right.
Remember? Because he was outside at one point. And she's like, no, you can just leave me. And he shows up, and she kind of manipulates him later on. But yeah, so she's a little bit off. And Joe takes all the other women down to the basement. As you had mentioned, he's got a weird torture dungeon down there, because why not? He takes all them down to the basement and says, hey, you either go in this room or I'm going to give you the same fate as the girl he had put on the table and burned her face with some kind of an acid.
Well, we got to add there that, like, those were all, like, those five were the five that he didn't need. So first Bruno got to choose one of them to take with him.
Yeah.
And he picked one, brought her out, and, like, came right back in because she struggled too much and he accidentally broke her neck.
I know.
Because that's how that happens. And then
I squeezed her neck, put boss. It made me think of Lenny. It made me think of Lenny from Mice and Men, where he just wanted to pet the rabbits and he kept killing the rabbits. But yeah, Bruno comes in. He's like, I put my hands on her neck, maybe too hard, and killed her. And so now all the other women choose the door instead of whatever Joe has in store for them. And they all end up in this room. He locks it behind him. And this is a super fucking weird thing that happens right here. Like, really uncomfortable, man. He goes back to Marcia and he's going to make love. That's his idea. They're going to go up there. They're going to have sex so he can get her pregnant. And he opens a trap door right next to the bed where we see all the other women down in the hole. And then snakes just get let into the room with them.
He got another lever to pull to get the snakes in there. Yeah. So like he's pulling two levers. First, he just opening, looking down, seeing all these girls. And then the second one, he pulls so that snakes come out and the snakes kill them all.
And this is the music that he wants to listen to while he tries to impregnate this Marcia. Is these women screaming as snakes are attacking them. And we get some really crazy shots too, where you kind of see the bed and you see Joe and Marcia on it, and then you see straight down that hole to all these women that are down there pleading for their lives. It was messed up, man. It was really messed up.
It's completely fucked up. But yeah, and then at one point, Marcia just stops him and says, I can't do this, please. And I think they stop, but then all the girls are already dead. So, we get the one.
The one girl. There's still one left because we get the same thing where she puts a curse on him. Or where she doesn't curse him, but she says, I won't die, but I'm going to come back and I'm going to find you and I'm going to make you pay for what you've done here. But even after
this
that.
This time I'll take your corpse. She says.
Right. I'll possess your corpse. He tells Marcia, though, you're never going to tell on me because you love me. You're never going to tell anyone because you love me. And she doesn't. She doesn't tell anyone.
That's why he lets her go, by the way, because she would be the perfect woman, but she showed love, and love is a weakness. So that's why he lets her go. And she won't tell on anybody because she loves him.
Right. And again, nobody can pin this on Joe, so he's still kind of out doing his thing. Soon after, he's still out there looking for a woman, and that's when the colonel's daughter shows up.
Yeah.
Right. So you've got the colonel's daughter, who now Coffin Joe is in love with.
She's coming to town because she's getting married, right?
I don't know if it was for a marriage or she was supposed to be like...
She had a reason to come there.
Yeah, there was a reason she came, but I don't remember exactly what that reason was.
Yeah, I'm not fully sure either. But yeah, and then he gets this crazy plan on how to get his hands on her.
Right. They're going to have this big party. They're going to have a big party. He tells her, he goes to the party. He pulls out a card, makes it up as an invitation because everybody else is still terrified of this guy. She's playing the piano, and he walks over and tells her, meet me by the like Red Rose Alley or something like that, some kind of a flower alley at midnight.
Yeah.
And so they meet at midnight, and Joe puts a straight razor to her neck and starts asking her all these questions. And she's just regurgitating all the shit that we've heard him say in the past movie and now all throughout this movie.
Yeah. Yeah. And that goes on. Also, by the way, his card is literally just his card saying Coffin Joe. That's the card he used to get in. I didn't fully understand, but now that you say, yeah, he's just making it up as a card to get in. That's probably it. But yeah, that's crazy. And right. Then he's asking her all the questions, and then he's taking her home. Right? No, he lets her go again.
Yeah, he lets her go again before this all happens because he wants to. I think he almost wants to marry her. Now that he figures out, because that's when the colonel's son, her brother, goes to see Coffin Joe to bribe him to leave town. He's like, hey, yeah. I'll buy your shop. I'll buy your land for market value. You just got to take the money and run. Coffin Joe agrees. But then when the kid comes back, he ends up killing him. And I want to say he gets him in the eyes as well, because he's got these huge, gnarly fingernails, like super long, gross fingernails. And I want to say
He's not getting him in the eyes. He's like laying him, strapping him to a rock, and then having a rock.
Oh yes. And because
this is where the traps get crazy. Yeah. Like, this is Saw territory.
This really is Saw level. They lower the rock down far enough to where it's just sitting on the side of his head after they had crushed a mouse under it, and he lights the rope on fire. And he said, "If your God is real, tell him to put out that fire then. And if not, then you're gonna die right here on this rock." And shortly thereafter, the rope breaks. Dude gets crushed. We get a scene of blood leaking out from underneath the stone. I completely forgot all about that. But that was crazy. Yeah. That was kind of cool. But they keep his body to frame the big dude, the big muscle-bound guy.
When
Coffin Joe plays cards with him. Because Marcia tells the big dude, she's like, hey, you go play. I'll be with you, but you need lots of money. You got to have all the money in order for us to be together. And I'll be with you if you can find the money. So Bruno goes into the bar and says, does anybody want to play poker with my master? And that's when the big dude says, yeah, I'll do it. And so they have this bout of poker. Coffin Joe wins all the money. And then we get the setup that they had framed the killing of the colonel's son. Bye.
Well, no. Then the big guy leaves again to get more money, and I think then he is struck down by Bruno, or I don't know what exactly happens. But then he goes outside, and outside we hear a scream. Everyone runs out, and we see the brother dead on the floor with the bag of money that he was giving Joe to leave.
Right. That's where they had framed him. Right. That's where they had framed him. And Marcia was in on it the whole time. She says, you know, she's still doing shit for Coffin Joe. She tells the authorities, well, this guy had been in love with me for so long. He was doing this. He was doing that. So essentially set up the perfect reason for him to kill the colonel's son.
Yeah.
And so now we get... Coffin Joe realizing this was right around that time when he gets dragged down into hell.
And oh yeah, because he finds out that the woman was pregnant.
Yeah, when he finds out she was pregnant, his guilt is that he killed an unborn child. He feels really terrible about that, and that's when he gets dragged down into hell. And surprise, surprise, really cool. They put this whole sequence in color. Everything else is in black and white, and this sequence is really cool in color. By today's standards, this hell is not very scary. And part of me felt like it went on for a little bit too long. It's like, shit, we're still here. This is a long movie for a horror movie from 67. It was like an hour and 50 minutes almost, somewhere right in there.
Yeah, I think like around that. And the first one was only like 70 or 80 minutes maybe. Mm-hmm. So like this was much longer. And yeah, the hell... Although not scary, it looks like this is one of those depictions of hell where I actually say, okay, I actually wouldn't want to be in that hell.
Yeah.
Like so often you get like a depiction of hell where it's kind of annoying, but not really that bad. But like here it's hell. Like
it really is.
It's people, but it's kind of funny. It's like people strapped to rocks and like one guy with a trident like going around and just like poking them and they're going, ah! ah, right. And then he goes to the next one, ah, and they're all naked, of course.
And you've got some, a couple guys with whips that are whipping people as they walk around, and Joe sees a manifestation of himself as the devil, but it's him. It's Coffin Joe is the devil, and they have a short dialogue back and forth, but pretty much the whole thing is just about individuals being tortured. Like, he sees hell, and you see walls with, like, hands and feet coming out of the walls, up out of the ground. So, yeah, it was
also
pretty...
Also, poops and butts coming out of the walls. It's, like, really bizarre.
Right. Yeah, it was super strange. So he wakes up from the nightmare and claims that what he's doing isn't wrong and that it was all just, everything's a bad dream. No matter what this guy happens to him, nothing is, he is so firm in his beliefs, that he can't imagine anybody disagreeing with him because he's the superior man. And so he's had this vision of hell now, and this is when the colonel decides he needs to kill off Coffin Joe. So he's going to hire a bunch of, they weren't really hitmen, but some kind of like strong guys. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, he hires some people. Yeah, it feels like he almost just tells the town, yeah, whoever kills him gets money, like in that way.
Because he's all pissed off that his daughter is now in love with the Coffin Joe character. He's really upset about that. And he's like, oh, this sucks. I want her free. So let's get all these guys and we're going to get this Coffin Joe. We're going to make it happen. And so they all band together to go fight Coffin Joe. And where did they find him? Where was he at? But I thought he had a weird vision. What did he have the weird vision outside? I thought he had a vision in the graveyard with hands coming up out of the ground. You remember all those
first
hands?
Movie?
When they come back,
because that's the
That was outside of the mausoleum. Yeah, right.
I don't know where exactly they get him, but then they get to some swamps where he's like, I don't know if, I just remember it's like this swamp water everywhere, but I don't fully remember how they get there. But yeah, they're at these swamps and then they're like fighting him.
Right. That's right. They chase him around for a while and they beat him up pretty good. They beat him up well, but Coffin Joe still gets the... No, I feel like we're missing a piece here. Because when did the stuff happen with the baby? When the doctor tells him, choose the baby or choose... Was that after?
Oh, right. That happened somewhere. I totally forgot about that. Yeah, I think that's before. I think he doesn't want to kill him because his daughter's in love with him, but because the daughter died.
Right. The daughter died. The doctor tells Joe and Laura, says, hey, either the baby or the mom lives. Who is it? And they both agree. The baby's got to live. He says this still might not work, and he tries the operation, but the baby and the mother both end up dying.
Yeah.
Right.
And
okay.
That's when the colonel then starts the hunt for Coffin Joe.
And so he's taking... So after she's dead, right, Coffin Joe goes out to... He's going to bury her? Because I thought he said something about she's not really dead. She'll come back. Like, she can't be really dead. And so he goes out where he had dumped all the victims. That's where they end up in that weird swamp-type area. And he goes out. All the villagers surround him. He has this amazing monologue. I still feel like I'm messed up because when did the tree fall on him? That was all before the baby? When they beat him up, he gets away. And then the tree fell on him when he's out there yelling at God and the devil or whoever will listen to him. The tree falls, which was a really funny scene because he's like, I still don't believe you, even though this burning tree fell on my leg. He gets out from under that. And then maybe that's when he takes her body because this is coming up right at the end of the movie. We're right near the end now where all of the locals end up surrounding Coffin Joe. The priest talks to him and says, hey, your soul can be saved. And I want to say almost Joe says, I believe in God now. Or does he?
Yeah, I'm not too sure anymore.
But then he falls
into
it. To
be honest, during the end of the movie, I kind of couldn't fully pay attention anymore because it was just so crazy that I kind of...
Yeah.
Yeah.
But either way, he ends up in this pond where he had dumped all these bodies and then all these skeletons rise up around him. And we see Joe slowly sink into the water, disappears. We get the end card, the end title card. It is over.
Yeah, and then he's dead for good, or at least, well, it kind of goes on because there's more movies. The next one is called The Strange World of Coffin Joe. I'm just going to jump into that really quickly because it's not really about Coffin Joe anymore. This is like just an anthology movie of like three or four stories of like weird things happening. The last story, though, is then starting with like a group of people like having a roundtable discussion. One of them is Coffin Joe, but I think he doesn't even say his real name. He doesn't say he's Coffin Joe. He says he's someone else. And he invites one of those professors at the roundtable to visit him. And that's the story I want to talk about really quick, because there we get once again this Coffin Joe is evil and always right in these movies.
Right.
So he takes this couple to his home, where he has this big like basement with, this time even more like, it's a torture dungeon now. He just has people everywhere being whipped and being tortured, and like I think he talks about how they kind of like it and do it willingly, and it goes on, and like these two people who came in new, they say like, that's crazy, let us go. And he doesn't let them go, but then puts them into a cage. He puts him, the guy, into like a glass cage where he's just standing up, and his wife he puts in a normal cage. And he doesn't give them any water, and like even does like a metaphor with the Bible where he goes on the first day, the second day, every day he comes back, gives the man some food, but doesn't give anything to the woman. And so after seven days, at the sixth day, she's still okay. At the seventh day, she's broken down. She the only thing she can say is water, water. And then Joe goes to her husband's glass cage and asks if he should kill the husband with a knife, and all the wife says is water, water. And then he cuts open the guy's neck and takes the blood and gives it to her to drink, and she drinks it and then even jumps up and drinks right from the neck because she hasn't had water for 7 days.
And that's messed up, man.
so fucked up. And here there's no bad repercussions for him. That's like the end, basically.
Yeah. But those ones I don't think count as this trilogy, right?
Yeah, exactly. They don't count. They're just like follow-ups. I just wanted to get into them really quick because I watched them and they're like fucked up.
Yeah, because the last one in the trilogy is Embodiment of Evil. Would be the one that came out in 2008. Right.
Yeah, exactly. And I ordered the Blu-ray. It's on its way, but it comes from Great Britain and they just went through Brexit or are just going through. So I have no idea when it comes here.
Right.
But I will watch it and then I will get back at you and tell you how the story ends.
Yeah, because it looks like I can rent it on Google Play or YouTube. But it looks like, I'm just looking at a couple images from it, and Bruno's back. And it looks like maybe the same guy who played Bruno. Is still still gonna be Bruno, so that's kind of fun.
Yeah. Also, I've seen like a video, I didn't watch it through, but Rob Zombie says that Coffin Joe was like a big inspiration for him and that he really likes him, and they had some appearance together. Him and
I can imagine that. Manas. Especially you look at some of Rob Zombie's videos. He has the same kind of a get up, you know, the Coffin Joe look. Because I wanna say I want to say even in Living Dead Girl, even though that was Caligari, I feel like he was still kind of dressed like Coffin Joe.
Oh, okay. Well, also he likes doing like these asshole characters, so also makes sense. Coffin Joe is like the worst, and he just like got inspired by him to make like the worst characters.
Right. And that's it truly is. I mean, Coffin Joe, oh, so bad, man. He's such a scumbag. So these movies, you recommend them?
To you, yes. These movies, they aren't bad. They're not great, but they there's something there. Especially because like this is actually the first horror movie coming out of the out of Brazil. Like that's officially the first horror movie ever made,
which is really cool. Yeah, that's cool.
And there is something to it. Like, you can see that it kind of inspired some people.
And, right. No, I think it's definitely worth, if you're a big horror fan, they're 100% worth a watch.
Yeah, you should check them out, yeah.
Yeah, you should check them out for sure, because very influential. It's amazing to think that this stuff was actually happening in the 60s. You know, you look back at some of the other stuff, like the Herschel Gordon Lewis stuff, that was almost more campy. Sure, it was bloody, but it was almost more campy, where this was really uncomfortable. Really uncomfortable throughout most of it.
Like, he went to things that he did things that I think the US still doesn't dare to do on a regular basis. Like, that's right. Not horror movies that we get even today. So and it's kind of weird that these movies, like, there are Coffin Joe comic books. There is, like I said, there was a float of him, but like over here, no one other than the people really deep into it, people don't know about him at all. Like, there's comic books about him. There's, like, so many movies that feature that character. And, like, we even you, who've seen every horror movie on Netflix, you have never heard of this movie. And the only way to get these first movies is, like, this one DVD box set from the UK that you found, that I found, that's the only one out there. Right. Or, like, on YouTube.
Like, and this is... Yeah, that's the thing. And that's really it. It's, you know, it's not as talked about as maybe it should be, but it is important. Super important.
Yeah. And yeah, it's sad that he died, and we wanted to do this episode sooner, but there were some things coming in between, and also so we had the time to watch all the movies and get to know this character.
Right. So good call, man. I like it. Good call about that one. So that's it for that is it for this week. And if you want to get into contact with us on all the social media platforms, it's at IHOH Podcast. If you want to email us directly, you can go to IHOHpodcast@gmail.com. And as always, if you would jump onto Apple Podcasts, leave a rate and review, that would be greatly appreciated. And for the International House of Horrors, I have been Joe Morrow.
Wait, one second.
Oh, yeah.
I think we just got a new review.
Oh, nice.
On iTunes. I just pull it up. Let me see. So there's a 5-star review by a crazy Star Wars fanboy.
Okay.
And it really depends. Either this was like from... How do you write your dates again? You do the month as first, right?
Month, day, year.
So I guess this review is actually from the 2nd of March 2020. So like just like a week ago.
Okay.
And... Crazy Star Wars fanboy writes, 5 stars. You guys mesh well. I love this podcast. You helped me discover some gems like Tourist Trap, Reanimator, and one of my new favorites, Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer.
Ooh, nice.
I've seen all the mainstream horror, but you helped me narrow down which obscure horror to watch. Keep it up.
Oh, awesome.
So, thank you.
Yeah. Especially, I love that name too. Star Wars fanboy.
Yeah, love crazy Star Wars fanboy.
Crazy Star Wars fanboy. Well, awesome, man. Glad you've been able to figure out a couple things here and there. Some stuff to watch. Yeah. Hopefully, now you've got a couple more you can watch. Watch some Coffin Joe. Find that stuff.
Yeah, they're on YouTube.
Yeah, those first two are on YouTube, and the other one, it looks like you can rent it and things like that. So it is available. All right, so thank you again for writing in. We really appreciate that. We'll try this one more time. For the International House of Horrors, I've been Joe Merle.
And I've been Josh.
And we'll be back next week with more things terrible, horrible, brutal, bloody, gory, and the macabre.